Hello and welcome to a football podcast. My name is Devang Desai and I'm joined this week by David Goss and Nick Andrade. This week we chat another TFC comeback, deadline day all around Europe, Liverpool and Manchester United suffer humiliating defeats, and Orlando surges in MLS once again. Gentlemen, I just want to say what a fantastic week of football. The beautiful game. The absolute beautiful game.
Are you talking about deflections or... Sorry.
a hilarious amount of deflections. Don't get me wrong. I watched the highlights back again just ahead of recording today, but it was great, Nick. I know it's tough for a Liverpool fan or a United fan to understand it at the time, but I think just the Schadenfreude almost sent a lot of people over the edge into the abyss of too much joy. David, did you get that feeling as well?
I got a text message from a Liverpool fan friend on Saturday mocking the existence of Jordan Pickford. Oh, how the tables turned right over the course of 24 hours.
Right. Like Jordan Pickford, you can make fun of him always, no matter what happens.
And Everton will win the league. Don't get me wrong, they will, but it will be in spite of Jordan Pickford. Don't get me wrong. Let's put our cards on the table here. But
I remember just watching that game, Liverpool, and I was just like, they're going to come back. It's 5-2. I feel it. And then it's just every deflection. And I was just like, I can't. This is just, I went from laughing to anger to laughing again, and then anger, and then sadness.
But that was the best part about it, was it was like 4-1 and 5-2, and you could feel Liverpool fans being like, we'll probably come back. Like, we just create right so many opportunities. This is just how we play. So then the actual 7-2 was the final?
Yeah, 7-2.
Am I remembering that right?
Yep.
Was like, yeah, this is what happens. This is your undoing.
And it's the cardinal rule that I think should be one of the laws we pass just as a society. But if you're watching a team that doesn't involve you, just as another game, and something hilarious is happening, but your team hasn't played yet, you have to keep the banter in the holster. You can't go off going crazy, talking mad spicy about Manchester United this, or disband this, or Ferguson who, or Ollie's a clown, and only to see VVD get clowned repeatedly and Liverpool get clowned repeatedly. It was just such a sometimes, you know, the game, the transfer fees, we'll get to the murky world of agents, not really knowing who's pulling the string sometimes, and forgetting about the real beauty on the pitch. You lose it sometimes, but watching the demolition of these two storied clubs made me believe again that this game could be saved.
Has Arsenal played yet?
They had played that day, right? And they had just survived after Sheffield had scored a nice goal. So it was another exhale, and then into, again, it was Spurs as well. That's the thing, it was Spurs. So it's like, even that, it couldn't get me down. It didn't matter who it was. I was just loving it.
So question for you guys then. What are the rules on banter? So if you're a Man United fan, and then they lost, and then Liverpool lost, what's the amount of banter that you can... Because I saw a bunch of it after, and it's like, you guys got destroyed too.
Nothing. No, don't get me wrong, Nick. I think there's general clownery run amok. Total. And people are laughing at people, and they have no basis at Liverpool, still far and away in a better position, obviously. But it was just a fun day to be online, which I don't say that often.
Yeah. I like the idea that instead of Animal Farm, the next sociological experiment will just be Devang writing about football fans on Twitter just being off their rockers. I appreciate that.
Before we get into the show, I just be remiss not to mention there's a lot of amazing stories going on the pitch, off the pitch with signings, but some dark news out of Arsenal. Gunnosaurus, the person who played Gunnosaurus, the man, I just want to be clear as well, it's not a real dinosaur. It's a person who lost their job. So I know there's bants and there's jokes, but that is extremely tough to see. It's a costume, so I think the club will probably replace them when the games come back. But you know, I was talking about how much I love this game seconds ago, and now to turn on my Patrice Evra on Sky Sports moment, Arsenal's about to splash, what, 50-plus million on Thomas Partey, and I understand it's different funds for different things, but God, PR-wise, just terrible. The optics, guys, wait a couple days, don't do this. More importantly, don't do this, but it was sad. That was the first thing I saw this morning, to be honest, and I woke up so early. It was very sad.
I just want to say, too, even though he is a man underneath that suit, The man almost becomes the mascot.
And I wonder, when he looks in the mirror without the costume on, who does he see back at him? Is it the person or is it Gunnosaurus himself?
It's 100% Gunnosaurus.
That's something we have to consider. And hey, if he showed up at Spurs Stadium next weekend and is kitted out in the Spurs gear, but still living his life, I couldn't fault him for that. So let's see what happens to him.
Matteo Guendouzi going on loan to Hertha Berlin. So the other Arsenal mascot also out today, which is huge. Back to back. But Hertha Berlin in their tweet put a picture of a dinosaur saying, like, coming from Arsenal. And as an emoji for that, they put a picture of a dinosaur. And I couldn't tell if that was like a deep cut sub. So potentially respect to Hertha, but I'm not sure.
I think Sevilla did the same thing, right? That they signed Gunnosaurus on a free transfer.
Right.
That's a classic Sevilla move. That's smart. Yeah. Playing the market.
After watching Harry Maguire this weekend, there's no doubt in my mind Gunnosaurus could put in 90 minutes for at least half of the Premier League clubs right now. So we'll see what happens.
Only 27 years old, so he's in his prime. Exactly.
Over under how many headers Gunnosaurus could get in a given Premier League year? I'm going to say 9.
With the state of the refereeing in this game, Nick, I would say they'd be called for fouls a lot of the time, but I would hope to say 10 to 15.
There's just no bite in the game anymore, Devang, you know?
Exactly. I know. Well,
it's just lost its soul.
I'll get off my soapbox to do one more piece of business before we get into headlines, but a reminder that we are on Patreon and getting closer to 30 of you guys, and when we get there, more interviews with people involved in the MLS. CPL, I just said the MLS, redacted star MLS. I know.
The MLS.
Wow. Someone's knocking on my door immediately. Okay, it's happening. I'll finish this read. Interviews, plus more card packs, chat on the Discord. Lots of fun on there, especially on game days. So head over to patreon.com/afootballpodcast. Sign up, get all the perks, and we'll see you on Discord. After the break, it's the headlines from North America and Europe. Welcome back to A Football Podcast. Nick, it's headlines time. Take it away.
Oh, baby. Lots going on, especially deadline day. It's deadline day. Things are happening. Arsenal's doing things. Debang is getting excited. But we're going to start. The Champions League draw happened on Friday. What matchups are you guys looking most forward to?
I just want to say I'm offended that you would try and talk to us about actual soccer games. All anyone cares about is transfers and who could potentially sign next. So, Devang, this is for you.
I'm not super excited for another installment of Messi Ronaldo fandom and the destruction of everything that you love online by their sets of fans. I'm not excited about that. I do like Group H. I like PSG, Man United, Leipzig. I think that'll be fun. I think there's some potential for fun in Group B with Real Madrid, Shakhtar, a good tournament team. I feel like Inter's in there. Mönchengladbach had a good season last year. But overall, David, a bit underwhelmed, I would say, by this Champions League draw. It feels like it's a little too soon, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think that's part of it. But I'd say, to add on to the two that you mentioned, I think Group C has potential. Marseille, having another big year last year, there's a lot going on today with Marseille, so we don't totally know where they'll be at going into group stage play. But that's exciting, and Porto has quality to challenge against Man City. And then I think Group D is the fascinating one of just the, like, it's like a deep nerd one of, like, Midtjylland like to use, you know, data for their team, and Atalanta to play a new style, and Ajax, you know, their training and their academy. But there's four very unique teams in that group, so it'll be cool as a, like, little bit of a science experiment of how they all mix together and what you end up getting. Because while Liverpool have had some huge success, you look at what Salzburg did to them last year and pushed them, and I think PSG the year before in the group stage, they can be, you know, had, I think, by teams that they don't face off against very often.
Just want to shout out Istanbul Bakshir, who's in that group with United and PSG and Leipzig. Nasser Chadli's there, Demba Ba's there, some blasts from the past, but a relatively new club as well.
A brand new club. This is like, right. I helped a friend work on a project about them, and there are weird political things happening in Turkey. They are not good for the average human being,
okay.
The president of Turkey is a dictator. Woo.
Is that his club?
It's like his new pet. So his like he has like in-laws that own it and a friend that runs it and all that type of stuff.
I just want to say, like, my favorite things is to watch the fourth team of the group get picked and then showing and then panning to, you know, their sporting director. And he's like, oh, no.
Yeah, this is bad.
All right. Deadline day, guys. Lots of things happening. We'll start with Man United. It looks like Cavani, Alex Telles, Ahmad Diallo, a youngster, a teenager, is also going to Man United. What do you think about what's going on with them?
Listen, I think they're replacing Lukaku 18 months later with an older player making also big-time wages in Cavani. Not to say Cavani won't do well with Manchester United. I think attacking-wise, they've proven they can score. No issues with that. Alex Telles, they needed help at fullback. Diallo looks pretty promising. Atalanta seems to know what they're doing in terms of developing players. I would be kind of troubled by the fact that they seem to know who to get rid of as well. And when you look at what they're doing, but look, I think the problem with Manchester United is pretty clear. Defensively, they're not well. They're a team that seemingly cannot defend. Harry Maguire is a bit of an albatross back there with the fee saddled to him and the fact that he is undroppable. They're not adding in the places I think they need to add, David. So I question their intentions this window, and I think their fans have questioned their intentions for many in windows going back now. And the fact that Sancho was not able to be completed is another shot at Ed Woodward, and it's hard to disagree with just the general mood that they've dropped the ball yet again.
Yeah, but we've talked about this a couple times, and it doesn't feel like Sancho fixes everything for them and is even necessary, which is kind of why I like the Cavani signing, because you have a young front three that can grow, and Fernandez behind them who fits in perfectly with them. I don't think you throw that whole thing to the side because you're Man U and you have to sign big names. So I like the idea of Cavani on a free, so you don't have to pay that transfer fee and have an expectation around it and say, whatever we get from you is gravy. We need options off the bench. We need a forward who does things physically a little different than Martial, and that's Cavani to a T. And also, I know he had injuries last year, but I'm not going to question the ability for Cavani to score goals at a high level ever, because that guy is a monster of a human being, and I wouldn't question anything around him. I'd be physically intimidated to be in his presence. And I agree with you. The question marks are defensive, and I thought a defensive midfielder was the biggest need for Manchester United, and they never went and looked at that. And I find it odd, but in the signing, you know, that they get from Atalanta, I will say everyone laughed about Martial 5 years ago, and I think he's a generational talent, and I don't think we're ever going to look at him that way because France is so stacked and he won't be the guy both at club and international level. But you got to make these moves early. Why? Because otherwise you end up trying to spend $150 million on Jadon Sancho when you could have spent 10 and gotten him as a young player. And a lot of clubs have to start looking at that. And we've seen clubs now over the last few years spend big on potential young players. And I don't think it's wrong. You just have to get your scouting right. So I think the idea is right. The execution from some clubs has been incorrect, but that would be the case if they were signing experienced players too. If you're signing the wrong guys, they're never going to work at your club. So I'm okay with that, and I'm okay with that young signing. And I think for Manchester United, it's very odd to me that Chris Smalling has no spot in that team. And I know he can be a joke at times because pretty much every English player is a joke at some point to English fans, but he's a staple for Roma. They knew they wanted him back. They finally make the signing here at the end. I think one of the bigger signings in Italy because of how well he played for them. And Van, you look at a team that concedes 6 goals and they're selling a starting center back is just so odd to me.
100% agree. I think it's because of the general stink left from the era that just really passed with Phil Jones and Smalling being tarred by the things that happened there. Phil Jones still there at United as well, which I had to be reminded of today. I thought there was a place for Smalling as well, but that sale to Roma is done. The other move that, by the time you listen to it, to us, should be done as well. Arsenal get Thomas Partey from Atletico Madrid after activating his release clause. David, we talked about him a bunch on this show, and you follow La Liga and Atletico very closely. I think for maybe fans that don't follow La Liga that well, what do you think this does for Arsenal?
It's a guy who can do every single thing in midfield. He can play in possession if a team's sitting deep and help you find the gaps and pick parts between teams and then make deep runs out of midfield to be an option on the end of crosses if that's what you have to rely on. He's a player who in transition makes the right decision, especially when you first win the ball and you're trying to break, which is what Atletico does so well and was the thing that he had to really learn under Simeone to get to that next level. And it took him a while. he's 27. He's really only been a locked in starter for the last two, maybe 3 years. So he's kind of slow on the curve there. But then he's clean in possession. He's clean under pressure. He can play out of the back. He can cover ground. I think he's one of the best central midfielders in the world. I think everyone's going to come around to that as they see him play for Arsenal, just because of the stage that is, even though Atletico Madrid go so deep in Champions League every year. And this is the biggest hole that Arsenal had. Devang, we've talked about it. Elneny's played well. Xhaka's had moments under Arteta, but you wouldn't trust either of them in both aspects of the game. There's moments where you trust Elneny defensively, and there's moments where you trust Xhaka on the ball. But Partey is a guy who can play both ways, and it allows you to play anyone next to him.
My thing is, there is a window here. Top four is, I think it's doable this season. I've seen some issues with his age, being 27, and whether or not a five-year contract is wise with the wages they're offering, somewhere around $200,000 a week, I saw. I think you throw that out the window. I understand you're trying to build and you're trying to get the likes of Oyuar from Lyon and get these attacking players when they're younger, like you were referring to with United and that transfer from Atalanta. But right now, this is the signing they need to make, David, not only just because of what you mentioned in terms of that player that they don't have, but I think it might also free up Dani Ceballos to play a more attacking role as well if he doesn't have to do some of the things that Partey can do. And I think we've seen that Dani can unlock defenses with his passing ability. Maybe that solution to the creativity problem was in-house for Arsenal. It's another top-class player as well, which is obviously so important. You need more of those guys, and Arsenal does not have enough of them. It's fantastic. I think it's a pretty interesting window, because if Gabriel is looking as good as he has so far at center back, they've addressed two massive concerns at the club.
Yeah, I agreed with you. And two spots that settle, I think, the whole group. Right. And when you talk about Van Dijk coming into Liverpool, and obviously we'll make fun of him later because of what happened this weekend, but what he did was make life easier for everyone. It made the fullbacks confident to get forward. It made whoever was playing him at center back at the time, it was Dejan Lovren, who had been a train wreck, a better player because they knew the quality that they had next to him, as well as the midfielders in front of them. So I think these are two players for Arsenal that do some of those same things for this group, and then pushes them to be an even better team in the league.
Bayern signed another winger. Just last week, David was going off on Man City for signing so many wingers. Now Bayern doing the same. Douglas Costa on loan. Can you make sense of that?
So Bayern get an excuse Man City doesn't get, which is Bayern won 5 of 5 trophies last year. So Bayern get to do whatever they want. But I think I was talking to you guys about it before we got on. In the Choupo-Moting signing, as well as Buna Sarr, who's 28 years old. These are signings that some big teams don't make. They consider guys done. They don't want to get in bed with players that they thought didn't play well at the highest level. You don't want to bring a 28-year-old who hasn't, quote-unquote, played at that level yet from a club like Marseille, as good as they've done. And yet Bayern seem to consistently have an ability to win now and prepare for the future. And that's what you see with Bayern. You look at the signings they signed. Mark Roca, who's only 23 years old, that they went in for $35 million last year. And Espanyol told them it wasn't enough. And then they get him for $10 million this year. Of course, Chris Richards getting a start at right back this week, just 19 years old. And Alphonso Davies as well at left back. Kimmich, what they've done with him. So I think Bayern have that perfect balance of they have experience in their club. And yet at the same time, they give young players opportunities. And Douglas Costa coming in, they lost Perisic. So they're looking for a replacement for a guy who can bring consistency. And I think they've also now brought in Moting to be a backup to Lewandowski, which was the only real hole they had, Devang. Although at the same time, they don't have to play a backup center forward because they have like 90 wingers who can break you down and be better than you.
I think it's worth saying something that you want to bring back a person that is aware of the situation at the club, a situation at a club where you're used to winning everything. Perhaps if you add someone with different expectations or someone that doesn't have an idea of what it means to play for Bayern, there is an adjustment period, but it makes sense, I guess, right? Douglas Costa knows what the deal is. It's a pretty seamless transition, and there was a hole. I don't doubt the things that they do anymore. I think we've lost the ability to do that, as you mentioned, David.
Yeah. And I want to mention for Juve, the ability to move Costa is because they brought in Chiesa from Fiorentina, which had been rumored for weeks and years, whatever it is, because it's an Italian and they all have to go to Juve and all those things. And I think it's an interesting signing because I think it could go two ways. You bring him in, you'd assume he'd play that right wing back spot, which Pirlo's used in the two games he's coached so far. Cuadrado's been there once, and I think Chiesa, this is the role he's played at Fiorentina. I don't think it's his best role. I think he's really a wide forward. But the way Juve play it with Danilo playing that right center back, it kind of makes it like you can be a true outside attacking player. You don't have to defend as much, and that's not Cuadrado's background as well. So it's going to be really interesting to see for Juve, but they've dropped their average age over the last month of their starting lineup from 35 to 23 very quickly.
I got to bring this up, but my boy Brendan Aaronson moving to RB Salzburg in January. How will he blossom under Jesse Marsch?
It's a cool move. It's a exciting move. Yet another American plying their trade in Europe, and he might get Champions League action if Salzburg can make it out of their group, which would be difficult. David, I think from my perspective, this is the logical step for Brendan Aaronson. I'm curious though, when the move is made in January, is Jesse Marsch sending him instructions now? Like, is this kind of like a, here's what I want you to do for the next so such and such time before you come over in January? Or is this now he's a union product and that's it? That's the end of the conversation? Or do they allocate playing time differently?
It's interesting because I look at Brendan Aaronson, I think in the end, we're looking at a guy who's going to play it as an eight at the highest level. Now, in the RB, you know, family, network, whatever we want to call it. They don't really play with true tens because they press high and do things differently. So I think it's going to be interesting because Philly's playing him in a different way than I think he's going to play at Salzburg. So do you put him on one of the sides of the diamonds, which would be more normal to what he'll play at Salzburg for Philly? Because you've already sold him. You don't have to increase his value by playing him at the 10. I think that's a question mark for what Philly wants to do. And I think Jimiro Montero is going to be the 10 when he leaves. So maybe why not start it now? But I think this is a great move for Aaronson. One, you go into this club, which has sold consistently to Liverpool, to RB Leipzig, to other teams in Germany as well. And then I think you look at the players that they've brought through. And I look at Campbell and Sabitzer as two players that he fits that model of good feet, can play as an eight going forward, and still have that creativity in the final third, but that's not his consistent role. And I know you're a big Sabitzer fan, Devang, and he's world-class, so that's obviously a dream comparison, but I think that's what Aaronson looks like in his future if he's going to succeed.
And finally, at the time of recording this podcast, there's about an hour left in deadline day. So we want to know, what teams do you think maybe missed the boat on deadline day, or what do you think was a success?
I like going deep here. I like what Hoffenheim's done. They got Sessegnon from Tottenham on loan, and they got Sebastian Rudy as well. So they basically brought in two starting fullbacks to a group, and they kept Kamaric, who's played so well to start this season. So there's a Hoffenheim team that was sixth last year in the Bundesliga, and I think they could push even higher. And to strengthen just straight across that back line today, I thought was pretty big for them.
I'll also go on a more positive track and commend Everton again. Not used to seeing Everton do good business during the window. I think Ben Godfrey from Norwich is another good buy, 25 million. Smart business. Also smart on them for sticking with Dominic Calvert-Lewin. I think the breakout star of the Premier League so far, an example of someone that really did need their chances, and it's a perfect storm of what's going on at Everton right now under Ancelotti and with the additions they brought in. But you're seeing the game-breaking ability of a player like he has, and many, many examples in the past of English clubs perhaps ditching their talent too quickly or regretting some of the moves they made early on. But DCL is playing extremely well. Everton looks great. It's a fantastic window for them. I think it's cool to see maybe not the typical clubs kind of breaking out and making such great additions.
If you had to put money on it, Devang, or make a prediction, Moise Kean, who got loaned to PSG because Calvert-Lewin's played so well and he hasn't gotten time, what do you think in 5-10 years we say about his career? Is he an Italy starter? Does he find his spot? Or is he one of those guys who floats around to big clubs and can't really get minutes?
I wonder if he follows the Choupo-Moting track, kind of, where he's consistently involved at big clubs and he's, there's a reason he's kept on there, but I wonder if he truly reaches his ceiling or what was assigned as his ceiling early on. I think he got a really bad draw as well with where he was at when he came in at Everton, where things really seemed to be off the rails. I mean, it was a year ago when people were lambasting them right for the transfer moves they made, but I will take DCL's career in 5 years, I think, even though he was joshed around a bit as well.
I think you guys are going all in on Everton way too early.
We are. You know what, Nick, we're doing it. We're doing it because I know behind the microphone there's a single tear dropping from your eye.
My left eye is twitching constantly.
My assumption is, I don't listen to the podcast. My assumption is you just edit all this out. And we come on and Devang says, welcome to a football podcast. Then a quick bleep of just the word Liverpool. And then he says, and that's all for us on the football podcast.
Yeah, it's literally just me talking. And then it goes to the end. That's it for headlines. When we come back, David and Devang break down our favorite matches of the week.
Welcome back to a football podcast. So many good games this weekend, David. Honestly, I feel like the bubbles in a lot of other sports have been winding down, NBA, NHL, and when those were going on in full flight, it made me kind of forget of how much soccer is just generally on all the time because it breaks it up. But this weekend, wall to wall, good stuff. But we'll start in Hartford, TFC. David, they just cannot lose in the home of the Whalers. I think that's the key, right? This is their new home. They stay there.
The Brass Bonanza.
I love it.
Do you know
so
about
much.
That? It's I literally great. Learned about that yesterday. I'm not embarrassed to say that. I don't watch hockey. I don't really care. But I just learned about the Brass Bonanza.
I'd be like, I think because of the hockey connection, a lot of people were familiar with it. But definitely the first couple of times I started playing, there was some confusion. But now we're getting used to hearing it. And we're getting used to TFC making massive statements against the best of the best in the Eastern Conference. First, it was New York City FC, then Columbus, now Philadelphia, 9 out of 9 points. A comeback victory after Sergio Santos gave Philadelphia the lead in the 5th minute, David. Last week, we said it was a bit of a tale of two halves for CFC against the Crew. And I think Q again made a hilariously massive save in this game as well. But overall, I thought Toronto was just by and far the better team on this field.
Well, I would argue that Philly, though, was for the first 40 to 45 minutes. So I think it was similar to the Crew game where Toronto hung around, which is fine. I'm not saying they were bad, but they weren't the better team. They weren't creating a ton of chances. And then the game continues to grow. I think part of that for Toronto is the amount of options they have. It wears down on teams defensively over the course of the game. I also think you're looking at a guy in Pozuelo who's so fit. He covers every inch of ground. And he does it for a full 90 minutes at such a high level. So he starts to find more gaps as other teams either try and break forward more and have space, or they just get tired. And I think you're looking at a Toronto team that they have a gear that no other team probably in MLS has, but definitely in the Eastern Conference. And I'd argue that's the better conference in MLS. And so it's taken them 45 to 60 minutes over the last 3 weeks to get there. But once they get there, no one can touch them. So the question for the game coming in for Toronto is, can we stay close enough till we hit that? And once we do, we're better than everyone in the league. And they've got options now. Josie goes off hurt. That would have been the seasons up in the air over the last 5 years. And now it's Ayo Akinole is the best young striker. So a lot of great came out of this game for Toronto. And I think it made it very obvious that they're the best team in the Eastern Conference.
And I think you can argue where things stand currently, Josie being in that 11 at his current level might not even be the best lineup that TFC can put out right now. And David, perhaps we can touch on the Josie situation now. He left that game hurt. I think the injuries have been a problem after signing the new deal, but also in the way TFC has been playing, I think some analysis has pointed at Josie as being a bit of the weak link in the attack. I was curious what you think, maybe a bit outside the bubble that I'm kind of in TFC fandom as an observer, because while I do get the argument, I still think that he's such a focal point from the other team's defenders that he opens up so many more avenues for TFC to do what they do. And though he's not necessarily contributing with what he's doing on the ball, I think Josie being there is just enough alone to allow TFC to do what they want to do attacking-wise.
I had a big conversation about this with Matt Doyle earlier today, and we were talking about, I think, similar to what you're saying of TFC's best lineup may not be with Josie on the field. I don't think that's Josie related. I think Akinola struggles out wide, and I've seen that his whole career. His best spot is in the middle. And so when you have Josie and Akinola on the field, that's not your best lineup. But I don't think it's down to Josie's performances when he's healthy. I think it's just down to the shape of the team and the way it works. I agree with you about Josie Altidore. I would say even on the ball, if he's not scoring goals, He might be the best playmaker in MLS from the center forward position. And when he's locked in, he's dominant. So I still think he's a difference maker in MLS by far. I still think he's one of the best. But what Toronto FC has been able to build is now they have depth and the ability to not use him if they don't have to. And it could lead to a situation where maybe he can finally get healthy after whatever this layoff is, because they don't have to force him into games. Because you cannot ignore, over the time he's been in Toronto, the amount of high-level games they've had to play. And when you look at the 2016 to 17 run with CCL of basically playing at a playoff level for like 9 months in a row and playing for 18 months straight, all of that is going to wear on a guy who's had injury problems throughout his career. There's nothing Jozy Altidore can do about that. And the team as a whole wants him out there in their biggest games. We saw in the CCL final, he played on half a leg and was still arguably the best player on the field. So it doesn't go, I don't think it goes down to Jozy's issues. I don't think there's anything he's doing wrong. But he's a player who will get injured. That's a reality. And now finally Toronto has the ability to fill in for him.
Ayo Akinola in the news because of his goal over the weekend, and also because of some reports out of the Canadian camp of where Ayo may play internationally. David, nervous yet? Are you nervous yet?
First of all, I already told you, Montreal, we're taking it back for Benedict Arnold, and then we're going to take Toronto as well. What do you think happens with this, and what do you think the read will be at the end? Devang, like, if he makes either decision, is anyone going to be mad at him?
I'm confident that no. I think it'll be accepted. I think the fact that he's playing his club football here, it obviously gives Canada and John Herdman a pole position. I don't think it's necessarily the case that they're driving in a Mercedes and they have Lewis Hamilton driving, though. Like, I don't think they can just cruise to the finish and win this race and get Akinola locked up. From what I heard from Herdman in that interview with Gareth Wheeler, our friend over there at One Soccer, it's not just AO either, which is a very promising thing. But I think, mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like Berhalter is not thrown in the towel yet either, right? But I'm confident he'll join Canada. And again, I think the more the better. It's giving John a hilarious problem where he has maybe too many options up front, and he'll have to change his entire way he wants to play to satisfy that, based on the fact that we don't have enough players elsewhere. But I'm confident, I'll say that.
So the natural reality to everyone is, well, he's a young player, he wants to get more playing time, go to Canada. But we just talked about his best position being center forward. Which of those two countries better depth chart at that position?
And it's Canada. Is crazy. This is bizarre, though, right? Like, I don't understand. It's a wild thing to consider, but you're right.
Even if you pull Jonathan David out of that spot, you're still talking about Kyle Larin, who's starting and scoring now for Besiktas, and Cavallini. So I don't know that it's as cut and dry and makes as much sense as we think. That's all I'm saying.
I think the key is we just don't open the border again. And the fact that he's in Toronto and we'll be there, it'll give us a leg up. I want to ask you about Philly, David. I thought it was shorter and where they excelled in that first half. I didn't think it was maybe as long in that first 45, but you obviously saw why they've done so well under Jim Curtin. But you have the news about Brandon Aaronson. You have maybe expectations rising a bit. And Philadelphia is a great story, and clearly what they're doing there is working, but they're expected to be in the conversation for the Supporters Shield and win in the playoffs. Does that matter at all to this club? Do you think that extra layer? Because like we've said, TFC has done this a lot.
So I think this is the first conversation everyone wants to have about the Philadelphia Union, because they've never gotten over the hump. And that's the reality of every team, but especially young teams that come together as a group where you're not bringing outside pieces who have won in other places. Always the first question mark. The second a team like that loses in a postseason or a big must-win game is, can they get it done? When I look at Philly, I don't see faults in big games because they don't have the mentality for it, because they're not ready to play. I think the reality of it is they spend less than Toronto, they're less experienced, and they may not be as good a team. But I would still say, going into any game, and the easy ones right now are Columbus, Orlando, and Toronto at the top of the Eastern Conference, it's 51-49 with for or against Philly. They have the quality to play with all those teams. They've had segments of this season where they've played those teams and they've outplayed them. And we've seen them win in the playoffs already. And we saw them win some big games down in the MLS is back tournament. So I don't think that they've had enough opportunity to show they can win. in those big games, but I don't think they've proven that there's anything systematically wrong with them in those big moments. And I would say if they make it to MLS Cup, it wouldn't shock me, because if they're on form going into a few of those games, they can beat everyone in MLS.
David, another positive result for the new beasts of the East? ? Orlando? For real now. I think we can comfortably say that. But I guess the Oscar Pereira project, it's all about the team over the individual. But Alejandro Pozuelo is the MVP, de facto MVP. There might be a consensus growing, but there's a couple guys in Orlando that you could probably bestow that honor to as well, to be very high up there in the conversation.
Yeah, when you look at the performances they've gotten when big players have been out, because remember, Chris Mueller hurt his shoulder at the MLS's back tournament and wasn't at his best in the semifinal and final. And I felt like Nani stepped up in those moments. It was Pereira in the group stage there. Then they get out of that tournament, and I think Mueller's been the one carrying them for large stretches. You've had a ton of injuries and rotation in central midfield, and you see Journey Urso play well in this game and get the goal when it's been Uri Rossell other weeks, Seba Mendez other weeks besides that. And then, of course, the quality that Juan and Moutinho can bring at fullback. Neither of those guys played this weekend in a 3-1 win at home against New York Red Bulls. So for Orlando, there's been a ton of talent, but no one's going to win it because everyone has played well for stretches this season. But it does show that they're dangerous, because it feels like you're going to come down to the stretch this year and games are going to be really tight. And so you may not have your best 11 for big playoff games. And Orlando's shown that they can beat people without their best 11, and they have a ton of different ways to go about winning games.
Perhaps it's best we end MLS talk with the enigma that is Ben Olsen and his ongoing quest to possibly be trying to get fired at DC United, with the latest evidence coming from their loss, their whooping at the hands of Atlanta. Olsen subbed in a player that was not on his team sheet. Eventually, the refs figured it out. The fourth official dropped the ball entirely, but just a complete comedy, which involved Ben Olsen telling Atlanta's interim manager to shut the F up. David, what will it take for Ben Olsen to jettison himself from his job? Will he have to drag trophies around the parking lot, George Costanza style?
I'm pretty sure he has tenure at this point, so he's just trying to cruise into the sunshine on this one. Ooh, we talked about this last week, I think.
We did.
We talked about him being in trouble, and I guess if we had had that conversation and Nick had chimed in and said, well, what if he subbed in a player who was ineligible? Would that make things worse? We probably would have said yes, and that's what happened. So I don't run the club. It's not my position to handle it, but I will say, they've had huge injuries, so that's hurt things. They believe what's wrong at the club is Ben Olsen, then other people have to be looked at, because he's been there as long as he's been there. And right. If they believe as a club that he is the only reason that this club is not performing at the level it should be, then other people above him, including ownership, have to be looked at.
We head to the Premier League. We touched off the show with our thoughts briefly, but we get into it more in depth and start at Villa Park. What the hell happened, David? I still don't know. A 7-2 drubbing. The Villans, starting off the season extremely well, lifted by keeping Jack Grealish around and also just doing great business in general, I think, with the addition of Ross Barkley, a proven Premier League midfielder, and Ollie Watkins, who bagged a bunch of goals. David, it is true, though, there was a load of deflections. It was very comical to see how Liverpool conceded these goals.
And I would argue that any time a team puts up a number like this, something like that happened. You watch soccer games when a team beats another team and they have a ton of chances, and it's rare that you score all of them. For example, Germany against Brazil, 7-1. That game has been played in that way in soccer a million times, and the team never scores seven. Just sometimes it happens, and I don't take a ton from it as if one team's seven goals better than the other one, although I do believe Aston Villa is five goals better than Liverpool, and there's no way you can get around that. Look at the form last season, of course. So it was a wild one. I mean, I think we like to watch the game and analyze things and see what happened, and I don't think there's anything that you can understand about what happened except for the fact that Aston Villa fans are having probably the best weekend they've had in a really long time.
Especially considering how just in control Liverpool looked against Arsenal last Monday, and just did not seem within the realm of possibility that this something like this could happen. But I was kind of thinking the same watching West Ham take it to Leicester after seeing what Leicester did to Man City the week before that. So I think there is just a a party ball variable been thrown into the Premier League. The teams that were in that European bubble in August have seemed to struggle with the restart and the new season. I definitely think things are a bit off, so I don't say, think it's fair to say that Liverpool are no longer the title favorites, but I do wonder if some things tactically, David, were exposed and perhaps that partner with VVD is not exactly set in stone. I thought Joe Gomez was the guy, but perhaps there is something to think about for Klopp there.
Yeah, it's one of the only question marks in this group. Also, you don't have a guy like Thiago Alcantara in this game who's going to help you control games and maybe not, you know, get as open as this one did. That's what he does at his best. So I think that's another element that they can still bring into their team. And they played three games in a week with a much rotated group midweek against Arsenal in the Carabao Cup. So that's an element as well for Liverpool. But if you've done the things you've done over the last 2 years, you can't come out of this game and say, well, there's something wrong with our club. It is an unacceptable moment, and it's something that Klopp said, and it's historic, which is fairly pathetic, but I don't think you change anything if you're Liverpool, unless you see this happen another time. There's no way you come off one result like this and you say there's something wrong.
It's good though, because now anytime someone talks about VVD being the best defender in the world, even though that argument does have merit, someone will reply with the Grealish gif of nutmegging him and embarrassing him, and the argument will be over. Because, you know, when you reply with a gif, that's case closed.
Boom. That's how it works. Done.
That was the second drubbing of Sunday. The first one, the eyes of the world locked on Old Trafford. Jose Mourinho visiting with Spurs against his old club. The first controversy, the controversy that really flipped the game, even though United got a penalty 30 seconds into the match, was the Anthony Martial red card involving Eric Lamella. I do have a gripe about this. VAR catches everything. VAR catches incidental handballs or handballs that perhaps didn't anyone else catch at the beginning, but we went back and we get it once the referee gets a buzz. But I wondered why the referee didn't get a buzz to look back at Lamella's actions during this altercation, David, because I did think it was harsh on Martial, and it did really change the game, to be fair.
Yeah, I agree with you. And then it's hard to say. I don't know that I have a good answer for any of this, because I'm halfway between the I don't want the game re-refereed and the, well, if you're going to give it on Martial, then you have to be able to have, you know, equality across the board. What would this game have been if there wasn't that red card, if there was two red cards given, Devang? Would this game have been 45-10?
I hope so. I think they would have cut. Yeah, I think it would have been up in that level. It's true, though, because I think even before, yeah, it was that bad defensively that you could even guess a higher score line like that. But, you know, United was a train wreck, and the penalty did mask some things. But I think Spurs had their way with an extra man. David, I looked at Harry Maguire, who was the joke of the century, pulling down Luke Shaw to aid Spurs in getting that first goal. Very comical. But just thinking about Harry Maguire in general, there is a problem at the back for Manchester United, but Maguire's not innocent, and he's undroppable, I guess, basically, based on the fact that they paid that much. They paid that much because of VVD, because of that fee. They're locked in on this guy. I feel like they can't drop him, and there's no solution that Ollie can do, because I don't think he has the ability, right?
Well, you can't blame Harry Maguire for what happened. I think it was the Greek police. I don't think it was Harry Maguire's fault. He's innocent in this whole scenario. Yeah, Harry Maguire is undroppable in this group. Now, they've already upgraded at left back with Alex Telles signing. So Luke Shaw, you won't see as much of him. And he showed his vulnerabilities, I guess.
Amazing challenge. Monster lash out challenge against Lucas Moura.
Which was a yellow card.
Amazing.
Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, this game was all over the place on a number of levels. But I think part of what you look at with Man U is the lack of structure. And I think Matic has physical limitations at this point, plus 30. And you've seen it in his game. And Drogba obviously isn't a defensive shield in front of groups as well. So you have an unstable back line. You don't have a cohesive style that maximizes them. Because even as much as we want to make fun of how much money Pep Guardiola spends defensively, his team doesn't concede a lot of goals and hasn't over the years because he plays a specific style that fits their talents. There's no way you can say anything like that about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. So then you have a team for Manchester United where you're lacking individual quality, and then you don't have ways to protect them and build the game for them. And then you're going out and talking about wanting to get Ousmane Dembele. I don't know how that improves the issues that you've had. So for Manchester United, I think this game was a microcosm of all of the things that have gone wrong over the last 5-7 years for them. They've been one of the most poorly run teams after being the best run club from 1990 through to the mid 2000s.
Absolutely wild. I will give some credit to Spurs. Well done from then, from them. And again, Sun is an absolute treat to watch. Not going to say Jose Mourinho is onto something, but I do think there is a level of stability that he could bring to an absolutely bat crazy season so far. And top four definitely seems doable, and Spurs should be in that conversation, because as I look at the table, David, the top four consists of Everton in first, Aston Villa, Leicester, and Arsenal. Of those four teams, do you think any of them maintain their spot and go to the Champions League next year?
I think Thomas Partey makes Arsenal a top four team. And I do think that Everton has the quality, if injuries fall right for them, to stay in the top four, not to win the whole thing, but to stay in there. So it wouldn't surprise me.
They are rushing the streets of Islington, not for the party signing, but because David Goss has bestowed the famous words, "We're going back to the Champions League. Get the anthem ready." You love to hear it. Fantastic.
Let's get Bakary Sag now and let's just start dancing, because top four is championship. Everyone knows that.
Oh boy. So much great stuff this weekend. Anything else, David? Anything else we missed that you, Premier League wise?
No, I think that's it. Obviously, Leeds Man City was as well played as I thought it was going to be. And I still stand by that the greatest call I've ever made was that Leeds will be the most entertaining story. Even in a weekend with all those goals, there's still so much fun to watch in the way they choose to play.
Perfect. After the break, it's the mailbag, hashtag AskAFP. We get to your questions from Twitter, Discord, and everywhere else, so stay tuned.
Welcome back to A Football Podcast. It is now time for everyone's favorite mailbag segment, Ask AFP. Thanks to everyone who sent their questions this week. If you didn't get the chance to send in your own question, just hop on Twitter and use the hashtag AskAFP and send them our way. Our first question goes to MLS Gone Wild, and he or she asks, how do you see the top four in the East finishing after these upcoming 9 matches in MLS?
There is a bit of a gap between the fourth and fifth place teams, which are currently Philly and New York. New York City FC, I think it's 5 points. So I think safe to say it will be Columbus, DFC, Orlando, Philadelphia finishing in that top four. But my order, David, and pick it apart if you may. Number one, shocker, it's the Reds from Toronto, TFC. Number two, Orlando. Number three, Columbus. And number four, Philadelphia. I've bought into Orlando enough that I'm comfortable seeing them in the second spot.
Okay. I would say, and it's really hard with the way the whole seasons are going, I would say on schedule, I think Columbus has the easiest one of that group, although Zeller Ion just went out with injury, so it's fair to question them. And I think Toronto is the best group of that one. So you know what? I'm going to take DeVang's exact one, and I'm going to say that's what I'm going with as well.
All right. Tyler asks, where's a place you've yet to travel that would have both fun travel perspective, but also a great soccer scene?
Tyler, this is why we're boys. This is literally my life. I just make up lists of places I want to travel to for both travel purposes and soccer. High up on the list, I want to go to Uruguay World Cup qualifier at the Monumental, and I want to go to Montevideo. So that's high on the list. I've been to Lisbon, and I actually went to a Portugal friendly, but I'd love to see Benfica and Sporting Lisbon do their thing, and Lisbon's one of the coolest cities in the world. That one, the Cairo Derby is a dream of mine, and I've never been to Cairo. And then I would love to go to Istanbul and see the 18 teams in that area, but obviously the big three and potentially playing against each other. So that's my list real quick.
David, could you run us through a prospective day of one of these trips? Like, give us day two in Uruguay from breakfast to end of night. Is that possible?
Yeah, easy. Get up early, wander down to a cafe, grab a local newspaper, get a cafe, get a little bit of a snack. You hang out, you get the vibes of the place. Then you hit like a good, easy tourist attraction early in the day. Maybe something with some heights. So you get a view of the city and what's going on and kind of like cue you in on what you need to do. Then you're obviously going to lunch for a very specific meal that you're super excited about, I guess. In Uruguay, it's probably some form of barbecue and steak and whatever. or maybe some really good Italian food, Uruguayan style Italian food. You got that. And then you finish lunch and you realize you're on vacation. So then you get into the wine. And then you just, you know, hang out, dip into the wine a little, and then you get down to the stadium kind of early, start to talk to some fans, try and group in with some people to get to know what the traditions are, what's going on. And eventually you're in the stadium and you're a diehard and you want Uruguay or whoever, what team you're seeing that day to win more than anything you've ever wanted in your life for about 2 hours to 3 hours. And then you forget about it.
Brilliant. It's a wonder strike. He's ready. He's put it in the top bin. It's Goss 3, other fans nil. No, I love it. Great. I've always wanted to go to South America just in general, and I obviously like to watch some soccer while I'm down there. So I will pick maybe Quito in Ecuador. Shouts to my friend Carlo. Watch a game with him down there. And I'd also love to see a match in Africa, maybe an African Cup of Nations match. I'm thinking of places I haven't been, continents I haven't been as well. So to tick a couple of things off the bucket list, I'm looking at South America and Africa once the world is okay to do that in again.
So obviously, this is a random pandemic story and not COVID-19 pandemic. And obviously, I was the least person affected by this ever. But I bought tickets, flights and game tickets to go to the African Nations Cup in Morocco.
Three years ago, the one they moved,
refused to host because of the Ebola outbreak. And so I've never been to an African Nations Cup game either, but it is my dream, and I would gladly go with you, Devin.
Would you though? Okay, you know what? Lock it in. We'll lock this in. We need to get. I think we. You know what we should do though? We should definitely get the insurance on the flight tickets because I'm not sure if we should lock that in just yet.
No, cancellation fees are waived now forever because no one can go anywhere and the world shuts down every 2 weeks.
I understand it's a very grim time in the airline industry, but I'm getting some very bleak emails from old airlines I've flown with being like, hey, you fly for $20 and we'll give you, you can fly the plane for 20 minutes if you want. I'm like, this shouldn't be part of the deal. Like, this is bad.
In my head, I'm picturing you two with berets getting your morning coffee somewhere in Morocco and magical.
You would have to roll me out of Morocco. The amount of tagine and couscous that I would consume over the course of that trip, I would literally have to go sideways to get on the plane.
Also want to shout out Tyler for the outside of the box questions most weeks. We really appreciate it.
It's got the goods. Tyler's got the goods.
And finally, Cameron asks, what's your favorite jerseys that you own? Inspired by David's FC Dallas taco kit. If you can explain more, David.
Yeah, FC Dallas did like a commemorative one-time taco jersey last year or 2 years ago. And I was fortunate enough to get my hands on one. I did purchase it. It wasn't a freebie, so don't try and come at me and say that I'm, you know, sneaking it around. But yeah, so it's an all-white jersey. It's not, if I'm being real, not like the most professional feeling jersey in the world. But it's all white and it's got basically a bunch of emojis on it of tacos and things that go in tacos. But it's pretty great. I would say, so I love purple. So I have a Fiorentina Mutu jersey, which I think was before he did cocaine, but I'm unsure. So that's a pretty classic one that I like to whip out every once in a while.
I wouldn't put that in as a statement down or as like a fact because it's impossible to know exactly when he did that in the timeline.
It was a moving time. What about you, Devang?
So outside of like, I mean, I have Arsenal kits, TFC kits. Some national team kits. I have a kit though. My sister used to live in Brazil. She studied there in Sao Paulo. And when she visited, when she came back to Toronto, she brought with her a Sao Paulo jersey, a Hernanes jersey, who is the attacking midfielder for them, who went on to play for Lazio and Inter and Juve. He was a monster for Lazio for a while, but it was from his days in like the mid-aughts. But I love the jersey. I didn't know much about the Brazilian league at that time. Obviously, new football there is massive and they produce a lot of good players. But it got me into following them a bit and following him and his club's travail. So that's one I hold close to my heart. I still have it at my parents' house as well. But I'd like to break it out of storage soon. So I think I'll go with that. No, it's the white. It's the white.
That's clean.
With the badge. Yeah. It's clean, but impossible to keep clean. I wore it to a barbecue once, and it was... I love mustard. I love mustard, but I'll tell you this. I eyed that mustard with suspicion and hatred for that entire barbecue because I knew it was coming after me.
You know what, though, Devang? I'm not going to lie to you. it looks like Hernandez also loved mustard and things at barbecues.
My goodness.
So you guys have that in common. Know,
when he secured that move to Hebei China Fortune, you knew he was eating good for a long time.
For sure.
I don't have a fun jersey, but my first ever jersey, Nuno Gomes.
Oh.
Euro 2000 jersey. That was my first ever jersey.
Just incredible. Gomes.
First of all, that's epic. And that was a great pronunciation. Second of all, weirdly, the first soccer game I ever went to was an FC Porto game.
Wow.
So I got a little Portugal connection too.
Nice. Love it.
Awesome questions this week from everyone. Thank you so much and continue to send them in. Nick, we'll close it out. Another pack. We've been riding a pretty big wave pack-wise. Can we continue it?
I hope so. I actually cut the top of this so that I could quickly access.
Yeah.
And here we go.
Doping.
I'm really, really hoping we get someone really good today. Oh, what? We got a double?
Yeah. No, just save 30 minutes of editing time with Nick cutting that with the scissors. So that's fantastic.
Let me just see if we got any ones that are worth mentioning. And no. So we have a card we've already gotten, Ruben Sosa from Uruguay. And then Nigeria team card, which is pretty cool. But
how nice are those kits?
The kits are amazing. They're Adidas, and they just have Nigeria across it.
Sometimes you gotta let people know, you know?
Yeah.
You don't want it to be a secret.
Ruben Sosa will be the guide when you go to Montevideo in Uruguay on this football tour. So that's the synergy we're talking about.
When we go, Dubang, we're going around the world together.
Right. I can't wait.
Podcasts around the world with David and Dubang.
We'll host a travel podcast on the same, like after we finish each episode, we'll just roll over and do a travel pod.
Perfect. Synergy, name of the game. That's it for another week of a football podcast. A reminder, a rating or a review wherever you find this podcast would be wonderful. We are on Twitter at a football pod. Hit us up there. Questions, comments on the games that are going around all the time. We're also on patreon.com/afootballpodcast. Sign up there, get Upper Deck packs, get access to our Discord where we can make fun of Nick Moore for Liverpool getting absolutely destroyed by Aston Villa. And a display that uplifted fans worldwide. That is it for a football podcast this week. Join us next time. We'll talk to you soon.